this is Jody Sweeten, and welcome to this week's episode of Never Thought I'd Say This with my co-host and best friend and also smart person licensed therapist licensed extraordinaire, something. Celia Behar. Hi, Celia.
Aw, I love that you're calling me smart today. I feel like 5 minutes before right. we five started recording, you were like, you're an idiot.
Uh-huh. Well,
it literally happened right before we started.
I like to start the show on a high note and then just
drop
like,
it.
Well, people maybe that tuned in for the first time go, wow, they know what they're talking about. And then by the time they get to the end,
they're
like,
fuck
them. That was an amazing car crash that I just listened to.
All right. Well, whatever.
It's, parenting stats time.
Oh, yeah. What are mine? Who are my kids? My kids are Harper. She's 12 and Luna, but I call her Lulu because that's what she is. And she is 7.
Yep. And I've got Zoe, who is 11 years old, and Beatrix, who is 8. And we have
29.
A very special guest with us today, Celia. I don't know why I'm calling you Seal.
I don't know, but that's all right. Everyone does.
Kiss from a rose. No,
I used to be like, art, when people would do it to me. Nicole Comercio used to do it to me all the time. I could reference my friend Nicole Comercio because my other friend, Lindsay Adario, is here. And she's known me since, I feel like 6th or 7th grade. Mm. Like, it's been a long time.
Maybe before, yeah.
Maybe. It was before. Dance, by the way.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
Yeah. But I'm going to if people don't know who she is, who you are, I'm going to let you tell them who you are and your parenting stats as well, because they just recently changed.
Yes. So my name is Lindsay Adario, and I'm a photojournalist, and I have spent the better part of the last 20 years covering war around the world.
Crazy.
So conflict and humanitarian crises and women's issues all over the Middle East and Africa. And I have 2 children now. I have a 7-year-old named Lucas, and I have a 1-month-old named Alfred.
Oh, wow. I did 1 month.
1 month.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. I know. Yeah.
I applaud you, my friend.
I know. And she's up and standing.
Well, he was delivered by a surrogate.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So
I love that story.
I really meant just because you're not crying because you're not sleeping. But yes.
Well, there are days. But, you know, I have a very proactive husband who is very involved and amazing. And so it's been okay. It's a lot easier the second time around, I think.
Yeah,
and also, I'm not nursing. So that,
right. Makes it a little easier.
Yeah. So...
Well, based on what you do.
So it's going to be a hilarious episode today because war correspondence and hilarious.
No.
Actually, though, Lindsay was telling us that you know, she said people assume a lot of the time that you're not funny, right?
Yeah. I think people are always surprised when I make jokes because they think I'm going to be very morbid and very depressed because I photograph really tough situations.
Well, and... let me just say that that's always my memory of you, though, is that not photographing tough situations, but of being funny. Like, you were always, you always had like quick one-liners and stuff. So my friend Shannon and I went to see you speak the other day, our friend Shannon, and you dropped a bunch of, like, in these horrible stories, you would like tell a joke, and it's just me and Shannon, like, are the assholes in the corner, and we're like, ha ha ha, because we know. And everyone else was dead silent. We're like, oh, they don't get it. Never mind.
Right.
Like,
so speaking of quick one-liners,
yes.
Our Never Thought I'd Say This of the week actually comes from Lindsay.
Yep.
So I never thought I would say that my flak jacket, which is a bulletproof vest for anyone who doesn't know what a flak jacket is a life vest that you wear swimming to my 7-year-old son.
Lie. Yeah, that was the lie she told her kid. The lies that we all have told our children, not about flak jackets necessarily, but that, you know, the lies that we have to tell our kids so that they don't worry about us.
Right.
And particularly, I can't imagine with doing what you do, how often you must have to do that.
Well, I don't have to lie so often, although my son asks very pointed questions now. You both have children
and seven years old. Yeah.
I mean, usually, usually I could sort of be vague about things and he won't understand the amount of danger I'm in. But when I came back from Syria, I was in Syria in February. And when I came back, I got home in the middle of the night and I left my flak jacket on the floor by the door because it's like 30 pounds and I was exhausted. It was 1 a.m. And Lucas woke up to go to school and he came downstairs and he was like, "Mummy," because he has a very thick British accent. We live in London. And he's like, "Is that a life vest?" And I was like, I hadn't even had coffee yet. I was like, yes, it's a life vest. And he's like, "Do you take it swimming?" And I was like, yeah. And he's like, "Does it float?" And I was like, Yes, it floats. Right. Like, obviously, right. It's super heavy. It's made of like metal,
right.
You know?
Right. But you're like, no, but it inflates and it's a, right. Yay.
But I just like the thought of him envisioning me like running right. through Sniper Alley just didn't work out. So I just thought, okay, I'm going to go with this one. And so I took him to school that day and I actually told his teacher because I felt so guilty that I'd lied so directly to him.
I was
like,
someone.
I lied to Lucas this morning. I told him, you know, and she was like, great. I don't really care. You know? So I just felt like I had to get. But usually he doesn't ask such pointed questions. Like, for example, I do try and show him a lot of the work I do. And I cover refugees all the time. So all around the world, one of course, the results of war is people fleeing and becoming refugees. And so I often cover Syrian refugees or refugees across Africa. And so one time I came home from the Democratic Republic of Congo mm-hmm. and I was showing him the pictures and mm-hmm. I was saying, you know, this is, they have to live in camps because they can't live in their homes and their villages because there's fighting mm-hmm. there. And he's like, so where do they sleep? And I showed him the tents and he's like, but there are no toilets. Where do they go to the bathroom? I mean, he was asking very good questions. And he asked about water. Where do they get water? And how do they take a bath? And then he was asking, you know, is it dangerous? And I said, no, they're living there because it's safer there. And he's like, but mommy, if they're running away from war, doesn't that mean you're very close to war? And I was like, yeah, but I'm fine. Like, there's nothing will ever happen to me ever. Yeah,
I'm in a bubble.
Yeah.
Right. Oh my God, am I the biggest dick right now that all I can think is, like, when you say that and you're showing those pictures that I'm like, man, I wish I had those pictures to show my kids when they're being fucking ungrateful assholes.
He's still ungrateful. He still totally has, he's such a spoiled kid.
Well, you know, I had this conversation with B because I, you know, like you were talking about, and I think one of the things that Celia and I have talked about and one of the things that we kind of reiterate, particularly on this show, is really honest conversations with your kids, that kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, that they are capable of handling a lot more. I mean, obviously, within reason, but that kids are capable of understanding and having really honest communication about topics like war and refugees and having them understand sort of the size and scope of the world. And I had this conversation with Bea before, but she did not handle it as well as your son did. She just burst into tears. Like, and
that would have been my goal of having that conversation.
Well, yesterday in the car, we're driving home talking about something. We're talking about this really horrific thing of a woman pushing a man off a bus or something and wound up killing this older man. And she just, like, that was it. Zoe mentioned the movie A Dog's Purpose, burst into tears because all the dogs died.
Oh, God.
I just ruined the story for you if you haven't known. The dogs die.
Nice job.
But anyway, it, like, having those conversations, and it is hard to watch your kid burst into tears at the thought of people not having homes or of not that realization that their life here is so vastly different from other kids in the world, and then using it as a weapon to hang over their head and go, look, you little asshole, there are people that have that. And it's true,
make my kids
and
call
I can't
you
imagine
from now on.
I can't imagine what
work.
Is it like right
why so wait why is he ungrateful like what is
no,
this
he's
what
not.
I
was gonna
say grateful it's just he's an only child he has no you know
well,
you can
anymore.
Have perspective well, okay yeah. He was an only child until a month ago, so that hasn't really kicked in yet, but I think, you know, it's like he can have perspective visually, but I think he's never wanted for anything, you know. It's not like he's ever had to suffer.
And what I was gonna ask is, do you find that hard as a parent when you've seen such horrific, awful things, when you come home and your kid complains about something stupid like my sandwich isn't cut into a butterfly or so? How do you deal with that? Like, I feel like there would be an extra layer of, like, you really have no concept.
No.
Of, you know
what
I mean?
So like the sandwich and a butterfly, all that stuff, I get it because, you know, we all were kids once and we understand those quirky little things. But I think what's annoying to me is when he, you know, my husband and I spoiled him way too much. Like, we buy him presents and we get him all these things. And when he wants more and more and more, and that's what annoys me, is more the materialistic aspect, not the sort of, you know, I don't like my food touching on the same plate or whatever. Because that's just
but
like being
a
kid.
My kids do this. They do the same thing where you're like, dude, this is
you
so, right. You have enough and you don't.
They don't know it. I mean, that's what's rough. So, I could see how that would be really, like, frustrating, because you've seen kids with literally nothing.
once a month, I'm like, Lucas, round up your toys you don't use and let's go give them to to children who don't have anything. And he's like, no. And I'm like, wait a minute. Hang on. Have I taught you nothing? And he just is like, he's not generous. And that's like, you know, that's not his fault. It's just our fault as parents, I think, because we've allowed him to be spoiled.
Well, know? And I think it's just naturally as a 7-year old, you're like, no, this is mine. That's mine. You looked at that. So that's also mine. And I'm just accumulating all of the things.
Yeah. And you know, our older ones do that no matter what. And the little ones will give the older ones anything they want to the point where you're like, no, seriously, that was for you at a birthday present. Like, keep it to yourself.
It's like the giving tree at this house. Right. Like the little one's chopping off her arms and legs and building out a boat out of herself to give to the older one. And the other one is still like, I could really use some apples too. Right. You know what I mean?
Totally. Like, could you cut your hair off for me? I really like it. Right. Like and they'll do it. Yeah. You know, I think it is partly like you're the first child, you know, kind of thing.
Sure. And now how long, you said you've been doing this for over 20 years. So how long, you were doing this for like 15 years before you had kids? What was the decision like for you to even think about having kids while doing?
So I know you thought you were never going to have kids and you thought you were never going to get married.
So, So I wrote a memoir. It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. And I talk very openly about this because I do feel like as a journalist who sort of walked in and out of people's most intimate moments, it would be very hypocritical of me to not be open about my own insecurities and my own issues. And so the job I do is pretty vastly populated by men, and there aren't that many women who cover war very actively, like going away, spending a few months in the field and coming back. And so for many, many years, I tried to do that, and I tried to have love at the same time. And of course, it was completely incompatible. Like, I had a boyfriend who every time I'd come home, there'd be like pictures of other women in my drawers and like he'd be cheating on me left and right. And I basically got to the point where I was like, you know what? It's fine. Just be here when I get back and like change the sheets, because like I just couldn't like
the bar just got really low.
That was the Mexican. What was his name?
Uxvall.
Yes.
And I, you know, it wasn't his fault. The fact is like, you cannot ask a man to wait for you for 3 months while, you know, I was off in Iraq covering the fall of Saddam Hussein. It's not fair. Like, you can't say, hey, wait, like, forever. But I did, and it got to the point where I just assumed I would never have a proper relationship because my work was my love, my true, true love. And that took up all my time and everything. And so at that point, sort of in my early 30s, I think I was 33 when I met my husband, and he also was a journalist. And, you know, we were friends for like a year. And then finally he was like, okay, this is ridiculous. We should just be together. And I was like, no, I'm not attracted to you. And he was like, yeah, you will be. And he was right.
He was very confident.
Yeah, he was awesome. Well, he still is like beyond confident. And so I think, you know,
I literally thought he was gonna go, well, he should be. And I was like, wow.
No, he was just like, yeah, he was
popcorn.
Right. Yeah. He was just totally like, you will fall in love with me. And I did. And like, then for literally from the first time we got together, he's like, you want a family, right? And I was like, well, yeah, but later. And I was already in my early 30s. And so then we got married when I was 35. And he was like, okay, now we're married. We're going to have a baby. And I was like, not yet. I'm not ready. Like, shouldn't we be married for 2 years before we start having children? He's like, then you're going to be like, then it's going to be hard to get pregnant. And I was like, no. So basically, after a year and a half of marriage, we made a deal. We made like a compromise. I would go off the pill. I'd been on the pill for 20 years. And I said, okay, well, I'll go off the pill January of 2011. And so I did. But then I never went home. Like, I basically went on assignment. I went from South Sudan.
Like,
basically went from South Sudan to Iraq to Afghanistan to Bahrain to Libya. I got kidnapped in Libya, was held hostage for a week. And in that week, I was like, oh,
second
shit.
Kidnapping, yeah, yeah,
it was the second time I was kidnapped. And then in that week, there was a night.
Hold on. We're just glossing. But by you just casually. Yeah, the second time you were kidnapped.
Well, because I read her book, so I already knew. I actually remember when it happened because it was all the news. And I remember that was like popped up. Because
in the Westport news.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember because I was following your career because we actually lived in the city at the same time, but never saw each other.
Sure.
And so I remember when you were kidnapped the first time, it was all over the place and being like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
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 Meanwhile, by the way, since becoming a mom, I dream of being kidnapped sometimes. Just as an FYI.
I'm still trying to.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what to say because I can't Well, imagine that. And
I mean, look, we can go back, but the bottom line is, like, in the middle of that kidnapping, I was in prison. I was, like, bound and, right. and, like, sleeping on this disgusting foam mattress that God knows what had gone on in there. And with three of my colleagues from the New York Times. And in that night, I was like, oh shit, I'm definitely gonna have to get pregnant now because I owe my husband. Like, if I live, like, you know, if I actually live that's through this thinking. Kidnapping, yeah, I was like,
I gotta get knocked out. I'd just be like, I hope I get laid again. I mean, I hope, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, well, getting pregnant. Like, I just kind of wanna get home. You know what I mean? Well,
like, A, if I make right, it out right, alive, if, right. like, just, that was you like, time number to one. Think. But then it was like, oh God, I'm going to have to get pregnant. And right. so I did make it out.
And then you were more scared of that.
But like, yeah. And then I got out and I was like, oh my God, I'm still not ready. I don't know. Because
you're never ready.
Obviously, anyone who has children knows, like, it's terrifying and you're never, right. you never really feel ready unless, you know, that is what you've built up to your whole life. And right. I wasn't that woman. And so then, like, in that first month, I was sort of vacillating still. Like, I don't know if this is what I want, whatever. And Paul... my husband was supposed to go back to India where we were living. Mm-hmm. And he called my friend Tara, who grew up in Westport also, called my friend Tara and was like, how do I know when she's ovulating? He literally put my ovulation chart in. Yeah. Put his ovulation chart in his my ovulation chart in his BlackBerry and called his company and was like, my wife is still really traumatized from the kidnapping. I have to stay on because he knew he could get me pregnant. Right. And he did.
Oh,
and like, that was it.
Wow. Yeah.
Snap. And it worked. That was it.
I got pregnant right away. That is amazing.
Wait, yeah. did you keep working the whole time that you were pregnant? You did, right?
Yeah. I worked until I was 28 weeks pregnant.
Yeah. Wow.
And I was in, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Kenya, Somalia, Gaza, the United States. I did a road trip. So I was all over.
Fascinating.
Isn't it? It's crazy.
Well, the thing that I love, and I'm sitting here and, like, you know, the three of us are sitting here talking, is the fact that, I think about, like, 50 years ago, even, women like us wouldn't have had the opportunity to do the things that we're doing.
Right.
And still be moms. And I think, you know, as the tides are shifting more and more to where women have careers and are moms, I hope that, you know, as much as I hate to say it, like, I hope, no, that's not what I meant to say. As much, that's not, scratch that, reverse okay. it. What I was gonna say is I hope that eventually that we get to a point where women like us don't get asked the question of, How do you be a mom and have a career?
Let me just tell you, she got asked that question.
Even though I desperately want to ask it. But
no,
she
got asked that question at the talk. And
yeah,
right
I constantly
away,
go, like, she didn't know what's the last time you asked a man that question.
Right. Well, so she was doing the talk. Lindsay was doing the talk with her another photojournalist, John, whose
Moore.
Name, thank you, John Moore. And you guys had done this talk. It was like, you know, an hour long.
We also covered the frontline in Libya together for 2 weeks. I've known John forever.
Right.
We've covered all of the same wars.
And he's got three kids. Is that what it was?
Three kids.
Right, three kids.
And never gets asked that
and
question.
A woman
Never.
Raised her hand when it was time for questions and said to and asked that question to Lindsay, and Lindsay shut it down and said, I'm sorry, I'm going to answer your question with a question. Why are you asking me that and not John? He's got three kids. He's the dad. He's right. sitting right here.
He's got more kids than I do. Technically, he's more of a parent than I am. Because he's got three.
She was speechless. She didn't know what to say.
Yeah, but it happens every single talk.
Right.
And it just drives me crazy. The question doesn't drive me crazy.
Right.
The fact that, like, men are not getting asked the same question.
That's what, that's you know. What it is. It's because
is that ever going to change?
I don't know. I don't know. And I think, I mean, to play devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I think it's probably more of a question given that typically we are the ones birthing the children. And so I think there's just an automatic expectation
sometimes.
But that's what I said, sometimes. And I think it's a unfortunate thing that people think that somehow just because you're a mother that you're more... that you are automatically more attached to your children than the father
sure,
would be.
Sure, yeah, sure.
That somehow we discount the fact and kind of, you know, set it up, like discount the fact that men could be that attached to their kids, that it might be hard for them to go to work and have kids as well, and that we automatically must be suffering because it must be so hard for us to do the same thing that men do and go off and go, this is my job, this is what I love to do. Like, somehow we put this thing on women that, like, well, but you would rather be at home.
Right. Because I mean, that's what I meant. Look, but doesn't it sound like a judgment? Or
it's a total
like a
judgment.
Right.
I get judged all the time. I got judged for working while pregnant. I got judged, which, okay, it's a valid judgment. But ask yourself two questions. Women who work in chemical factories in America, women who work in completely unhealthy situations, why
nail
is that okay?
I just read a whole thing about nail salon workers. That
I mean, well, the chemicals, everything. Why is that healthier than me covering pregnant women in Afghanistan? It's not like I'm covering frontline, you know, all of those places I went when I was pregnant. I was covering a drought. I was covering pregnant women, you know.
Right, who are all in refugee camps who are suffering.
Well, not
through,
only
you
in
know.
Refugee camps. I mean, like, all over, just in their homes. In like, I was doing stories on women in Afghanistan and in Saudi Arabia. And so no one worries about those women.
Right.
Why? Because they're lesser than us? I don't think so. So I think there are a lot of questions you need to ask yourself before you judge people. And people's, like, automatic go-to is, let me judge this woman because she's pregnant. I think that's, like, that's not okay.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I know for myself, like, you know, doing what I do. And even when I wasn't working in entertainment and I was working in drug and alcohol treatment, I worked full time and I was always on call. I had to work on holidays. I mean, at least now I get holidays off. Mm. I would have to work on Thanksgiving. I'd have to work on Christmas. I'd have, you know, there was no, and it was,
I still do,
a career that I really wanted to have. And so I was like, well, no, this is, I get to have both.
Yep.
But I judged myself for it. And I do, I still do when I'm gone for, you know, a month at a time and I'm missing the kids' talent show and I'm missing this. And I look at myself and I go, you're letting them down. You're going to miss out. You're missing out on the things. And this is what's important and all this stuff. But I will say I have talked myself down and I've had honest conversations because I have two girls, Zoe and Bea. And I've had conversations with them. And I said, look, here's the deal. When you were an adult woman, you're going to have to make some hard decisions. Mm-hmm. And I want you to always follow the thing that makes your heart sing. Always follow what, like, just because you become a parent or become a wife or whatever to someone doesn't mean that you are going to, that I want for you more than anything to know that you as a woman have the same opportunities that anybody else. And just because you're married or with a man or a woman or whatever you want or have kids or don't have, you get to do that too. And don't ever stop chasing your dreams and stop giving up on stuff because suddenly you think that now you can't have both of those things.
Right. Sure.
You know, that there are sacrifices that have to be made. And I think women like you are such an amazing example of that sort of thing of like, look, this is my, like you said it, this is my love.
You're really super open about though, Lindsay, in your book, like, and I loved that you said it when you were talking about the boyfriend that you just had referenced when you guys were first together, and I think it was the fall of Saddam Hussein. You came home.
Oh, Afghanistan! It was the fall of the Taliban.
Fall of the Taliban. You came home because he was like super pissed at you. If memory
serves, he broke up with me. I was like in a dingy hotel room in Peshawar at the border with Afghanistan in Pakistan. And he dumped me. He's like, I want a girlfriend in flesh and blood. I want a girlfriend who's actually physically here. And me, being very sort of young, naive, and stupid, and like very much in love, was like, okay, I'll get on the first plane and come back, thinking that like my lifestyle would ever be okay for him. But obviously, you can't change people. You can't ask things of them that they're not ready to give. And so I went home and I missed the fall of the Taliban in Kabul, but then I ended up going back for Kandahar, and we eventually broke up. I mean, it just was not sustainable, that me always compromising my work.
But I love that you owned that in the book, because she like is like, you know, I, for the first time ever, you know, she was like, I gave up my passion to like, you know, go be with a man, and then it really backfired. And you like talk so openly about the fact that you were like, I'm not going to do that again, which I think is exactly what we're trying to teach, you know, our daughters, is to not do that.
Yeah, I think that was oftentimes a position that women of our generation, but particularly our mother's generation, you know, that the feminism and the post-feminism of the, you know, late 60s, early 70s and all that came up, women still found themselves in a position of having to choose a career and passion and love for what they do and mm-hmm. love for their children. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, it just like you don't have a favorite kid. Well, that's not always true. No, you're not supposed to. Just like you're not supposed to have a favorite kid.
Depends on the day.
Right. And you can love all of those things. Like, right. It doesn't mean that just because I'm the same way. I absolutely love what I do. Do I hate that I have to be gone for a month at a time and, you know, Canada of shooting course. Or whatever? Absolutely.
I hate it.
Sure.
You miss me. Probably more than my kids.
I said that before.
Of course.
Yeah.
But I also go, but you know what? This is what I love to do. And at the end of the day, if I show my kids what a strong woman looks like, then I'm doing a pretty damn good parenting
job. And also, not only what a strong woman looks like, but also someone who's passionate about their work and their love. Mm-hmm. And like, what better role model can you be? You know, and I always say that about my son. It's like, yeah, it's hard to be away all the time, but I want him to see a woman, you know, out there passionate, doing her call. You know, for me, it's really like a calling and to have that. And, you know, look, we've had some tough conversations, my husband and I, where before we decided to have our first son, you know, I said, look, I'm still going to travel. So are you going to stop traveling? And he agreed to it and I've held him to it and he's been amazing, you know, so he made a lot of sacrifices, but those were conversations we had ahead of time. And maybe that wouldn't have happened 50 years ago, but definitely, you know,
not. Well, unless you're Ruth Bader Ginsburg and you married, you know, but those are the stories that I think that, you know, we see. And even now I find myself going like, oh, that's so great. Like he gave, and I'm like,
wait, hold on,
you know, and I find myself trapped a bit and I go, wait, we as women do that all the time.
Right.
How many women have given up amazing careers in law?
That's like, that's like dads in general, right? I mean, you see it online when people like, you know.
Like, oh, he took his baby out. He's being a fucking parent.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like I take my kids to the park and people are like,
can you get out of my way?
Yeah.
Well, that's because you're screaming, you little fucking bastards, at them loudly in public. No,
that's right outside near my next door neighbors. Excuse me.
Right, yeah. Like,
that's just so everyone can hear. Or in the drop-off line. Right. Whatever. No, it's. I think there's, again, like, that's a huge double standard. I'm totally going to, like, segue into something just because it just dawned on me because our last episode. Like, your parents are, you don't have the typical story of growing up, especially not in Westport, Connecticut.
Right. So my parents met in hairdressing school. Which
maybe
we were
should
like,
have been
oh,
a tip.
I feel like I know where the story's going.
Maybe a tip to Camille.
Maybe. Like, you don't marry the guy you meet in hairdressing school, you know? So they met in hairdressing school. She came from like a super conservative Italian American family, as did he.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they got married and opened a very successful salon in Connecticut. And we're married 17 years and had 4 kids and basically had sex 4 times. And she got pregnant all 4 times. And then he fell in love with my mom's best friend, Bruce. And my dad and Bruce have been together for 35 years.
They're still together, right?
35 years. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, of course, it was tough on everyone when he came out. Particularly my dad, because it was something that he had suppressed for how many years. And my mom, of course, because she, you know, her whole fairy tale life fell apart.
And this was also like early 80s, late 70s.
This is 19.
Right?
So he came out, I think, to my mom and my sisters in 1979, but I was the youngest of 4 girls. And so he left in 1982. And then they got divorced after, but yeah, he left in 82. So that was pretty early on in like the, you know, gay father.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so
it was the talk of Westport.
It was the talk of the town, especially because they were basically everybody's hairdresser.
Yeah,
so
everybody.
It's like,
it was like
you
the
know,
only
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and you couldn't go talk to your hairdresser about it now. So
I couldn't go to a hairdresser in general, apparently. Thanks,
and
mom.
Like the irony of course is like the three of them are very, very close now and they're
that,
all
though.
Still hairdressers and like, you know, we go on vacation, all of us as a big family. And yeah, so.
Well, and I said this before the episode aired, but we've joked about it a bunch of times, you know, before we started typing, but we joked about it on this episode or on this podcast a lot about how terrible my hair was as a kid. And I said this to you and I'm going to say it, you know, just again, shout out to your mom. Your mom was the one that pulled my mom aside and said, stop doing that to your daughter's hair. Stop cutting her hair and brushing it out. That's ridiculous. Bring her in. Let us fix her hair. Leave it alone.
It was like a mushroom, sort of. It just went.
It was just a big. I was nicknamed Fro for the longest time. Like, I had the biggest Isro that ever existed.
Did you just call it an Isro?
Yeah. If it's not an Afro, it's an Isro. I'm a Jew. What, you've never heard that before? Is that like a Jewish thing? Which is underground?
Wish everyone could see my face. First of all,
it is. She's her mouth's wide open.
I've never heard that. Yeah. I've heard like the Jewish fro,
a Jew fro,
but never an Isfro.
An Isro.
And now,
an Isro. Yeah.
Isro, excuse an Isro. Me, an Isro. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's it.
Good. Forever, now,
forever now. Yeah, and in Israel. Come on, yeah, right. You know what I'm talking
about. I was just there, actually.
Were you?
All of our podcast listeners can now tag their fantastic pictures. Hashtag Israel.
Israel. Hashtag Israel. Is that, have you heard it before?
No, I haven't heard it before.
Yeah. Maybe I made it
hashtag
up.
And also, name of the episode.
Hashtag Israel.
Sweet. Not anything about Lindsay and her amazing life.
No.
That's all right. I don't need that.
No. Just Israel. We're just talking about my hair.
Yeah.
You know, how Camille saved me. Whatever. Right now you're working on a project and first of all, you guys have something in common in a weird way, the two of you, and you don't know it. But you've been working on maternal mortality. Which you talked about a little bit at the talk. You've also written or done pictures. I've watched them. That one that you've posted about the woman that you watched bleed out.
Mama Cece.
Yeah. That has, that stuck with me. I remember when you posted it. So you're covering it. You did say in the talk, and I'd love for you to talk about it and tell Jody the story about something you witnessed here and something that, again, I'm sure you never thought you'd have to say in this country, which is one, we are the number one country holding, like, right, we the highest death rate of maternal
The highest maternal mortality rate, second to Serbia in the developed world.
That's
so
crazy.
Which is astonishing.
Yeah,
and
Rachel
women
just
of
gasped.
Color.
I just heard her gasp.
Yeah, I mean, women of color are three times more likely to die in childbirth in America than white women. And there are many, many reasons for it, but a lot of it has to do with sort of unconscious bias and racism across the board. Mm-hmm. And there was a story, I've been covering maternal mortality for about a decade now. So I started the work in Afghanistan and Sierra Leone, and I started looking at like what were the reasons, because at that time in 2010 or 2009, about more than 500,000 women were dying a year in childbirth, which is unbelievable. And
really
98%
is.
Of those deaths were preventable. So what I wanted to look at as a photographer is why, you know, what were the causes and how can we sort of bring that number down as a society? Mm-hmm. And so the reasons why there weren't medical professionals available, there were very few roads, there was not access to a hospital or a clinic. You know, there was no prenatal care, things like prenatal care. There are indicators that, you know, if a woman has high blood pressure, she might end up with preeclampsia.
Yeah, placenta previa.
Yeah. Right. There are many, many, you know, with simple prenatal checks and postnatal checks. I mean, a lot of maternal deaths happen in the first 6 weeks after childbirth. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's a time when people don't realize it's still very, very sensitive. And so
posteclampsia is a thing, right? It's not preeclampsia. You can have it. You can get the same thing after you have a child.
I don't think so, because I think
it's called something, but it's like that.
You can have you can hemorrhage, you can have procretia, you can have
that's
when part of the placenta is stuck to your uterus and then it causes bleeding. There are so many complications. Oh, and so basically I started looking at that, and then National Geographic, knowing that it's a project that I've sort of taken on for the last decade, they came to me and said, will you look at this in America? And so I did. And so I traveled all across the U.S. I met with a lot of women in the U.S. who, and I spent time with them in during their delivery, labor, and after delivery. And there was one woman, of course, I wanted to feature women's families, you know, mothers who had died in childbirth. And so I was in Florida, or I heard about this woman who had died, and she was in Florida, and I flew there. First, I sent the mother a message on Facebook. And what I realized doing this story is the extraordinary racism in this country that I'm not familiar with, because I've lived abroad for 20 years.
Right.
So I messaged her and said, you know, I'm with National Geographic, I'm doing this story, and can we meet? And she basically was like, look, it's a super sensitive time. Her daughter had died 6 days before. And finally, I was like, look, this might be able to help, it might be able to help women across the country, women of color across the country. And so she was like, okay, come. And so I went to her house and she explained the story. She said, you know, her daughter had delivered and it was, I think it was like 48 hours within 2 days of delivery. And her 3-year-old daughter had found her mother slumped over the tub, foaming at the mouth. She was having sort of seizures. She was having a stroke. And so the 3-year-old called the grandmother and said, you know, look, but call, you know, mommy is not good. So she called an ambulance. The first responders came and it was in Florida. And the first responders came and looked at the mother who was black and said, you know, do you have $500 for an ambulance? Literally didn't take the vitals of her daughter, didn't do what a first responder should do as a responsibility to save a life, and said, do you have $500 for an ambulance? Meanwhile, her daughter was dying and she, like, there was a fight. Like, the mother was like, how the fuck can you ask me that? Like, as any mother would, and like, get my daughter to the hospital. And there was literally a fight. So finally, she like threw her daughter in the back of her own car, drove her to the hospital. Her daughter ended up dying. And so the mother told me this story and I was crying. Like, I was hyperventilating crying because I was so, not only was I ashamed of like the racism in this country, but can you imagine being a mother? Like, my heart was so broken. And I just sat and she's looking at me like, yeah, well, I've had a lifetime of this, you know? And I just was like, well, I'm so sorry. Like, I've lived abroad so long. I don't even know.
Right. But I think thanks in part due to journalists like you and people who are really looking into this, you know, like you said, I don't think anybody would expect that maternal mortality is so high in this country because we think, well, we pay so goddamn much for
insurance
and health and all the stuff that we must have the best healthcare, and we don't. And, you know, I almost died having Beatrix, my second one.
That's what
you
have in common.
That's what we have in common. Right.
I know this story.
If only you'd been there, I could have been a National Geographic. And it was unexpected, and it was, I had a C-section and I just wasn't recovering. My heart rate tanked. My blood pressure tanked at the same time. My heart rate was like 30 beats a minute.
How soon after?
Right after. I was still right after. I never made it out of recovery.
Wow.
And my abdomen filled up with 2 liters of blood.
Wow.
And they had to take, but they didn't know it. So I was sitting there for several hours and just getting more and more uncomfortable. And I was in agonizing pain because it was pushing on my spinal column and all this stuff. And they took me back in for like almost a 5-hour surgery, brought in several specialists because no one could figure out where it was, what was happening and why I was
bleeding.
They
never did, right?
No. Yeah. And I was in ICU for several days. I had 5 blood transfusions. I didn't get to see B those first couple days. I thought I was dying. The last thing I remember being taken into surgery is I couldn't lay flat. And I remember grabbing onto my doctor who I loved, who I'd known, you know, has been my doctor for years since I was 13 or 14. And just saying, please, please, I haven't seen the baby. I haven't seen the baby because I knew that was all I wanted. I just wanted to make sure that I could see her. And, you know, they told my mom to go pray in the chapel and they had to call her back at midnight and all this stuff. It was a really, really scary time. And again, looking back on that, and then, you know, I've talked to other women about it and they're like, oh yeah, I have a friend this happened to, or I know someone who died in childbirth, right? Yep. And I think we assume it's 2019, we're in a developed nation, like, how often are you, unless something really horrific happens, unless the woman doesn't know she's pregnant or gets really terrible prenatal care or none at all, that we have come beyond that and that we're more advanced than that, and we're not.
Well, we also assume that all women get the same care, and your story just, you know,
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not, and that I can't so even, yeah, that is, so this is unreal, and I...
Must kill. I mean, it's, but your story unfortunately is happening, playing out across the country,
and thank God. You know, I mean, and when I think about the fact that maybe because I'm not a woman of color, I got a different level of care, or somebody believed me when I said I can't sit up, and my abdomen hurts.
But that, you know, there was
someone
a guy,
believed me. I can't imagine having someone look at me and be like, "Oh, you must be drug seeking," or "Oh, you must," like, I or saying to that mother, I It is unreal. It is unreal that that's...
There was a... Wait,
Charles, we focused on another family and a husband, Charles, who was with his wife, Kira. She delivered in Los Angeles. He is like, they are an unbelievable... I mean, they were an unbelievable couple. So, like, you know, and they went to the hospital to deliver. She had a C-section. Same thing. He noticed a few hours after delivery, her catheter was filling up, or her IV had like the tinge of blood in it.
Right. Oh, God.
And so he called the doctor and he's like, hey, you know, I think something's wrong. And they're like, yeah, we'll order a CT scan. And I think 11 hours went by, and he, you know, it was incredible because when you talk to him, he was weighing in his mind, like he was getting more and more anxious. And he's like, look, do I take the risk of like raising my voice and becoming the angry black man who gets thrown in prison because I'm making a scene? And he's like, you know what? I'm going to trust the doctor. I'm just going to go with this. And she died.
Oh my God.
And it's like, she was like, spoke, I don't know how many languages, skydiver, like he's a lawyer. God. Like they were this incredible couple. He was left with two small children and she died. Because he basically was scared of like getting thrown in jail for being a screaming black man in a hospital in Los Angeles, you know? And I think it was Cedars-Sinai. And it's like, you know, it was really sad. And so these stories, I mean, over and over I heard across America.
Wow. I'm so glad you're doing this work. I mean, all the work that you've done is so crazy important. And it's, you know, it brings, and not just because I, you know, because I grew up with you, but it, you know, I would feel that way regardless, but it's certainly, you know, been, I'm so like honored to be able to say that I know you and follow your story. Cause what you do is so amazing. And you know, like way to make us all feel like assholes. No, just kidding. But it's, I'm so happy you're doing this about maternal stuff, because I do think that's something that like nobody talks about at all.
And you have written two books, as you said. What, give us the names of those again. Yep. So any of our listeners that want to check them out, because as you can tell, she has some pretty amazing stories and is super,
we could talk to her all day.
We could, but
we'll probably turn off the right.
But what are your books again?
So the first book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, and that is a memoir. It's really a memoir. So there's some photos, but it's really sort of my personal journey as a woman becoming a war photographer, growing up in Westport, Connecticut, becoming a war photographer, and sort of my struggle with how to start a family and balancing that. And then the second book I did just came out. It came out in October, and it's called Of Love and War. And it's a photo book. It's sort of a coffee table book of a lot of my images from over the years. But interspersed, I've included, there are short pieces by journalists I've worked with. Also, Christy Turlington wrote a piece about maternal mortality. She founded Every Mother Counts because she herself had a scare in childbirth. And also my personal journals and letters to friends over the years.
Wow, amazing. Yeah. I'm definitely going to go get your books, because those sound incredibly important and something that I would love
you
would laying around my house for my girls to see, another example of a really incredibly strong woman and mother. Totally. So thank you. And thank you. For those of you that want to follow her on Twitter and Instagram, it is at Lindsay Addario, LynseyAddario. And Lindsay Addario Photography on Facebook. And make sure to get her two books. Now, we have funny things, right?
Oh, yeah, always.
Well, right. I mean, first of all, I'm really proud of us that we kept it together and really dealt with a serious topic for as long as we did.
That's kind of a first.
I mean, I had one snarky comment, but
I threw in a couple shitty things.
That's
too.
That's true. Okay,
you know, we wouldn't be proud us of if us. We didn't do
we
that.
Can. We actually can do it.
We can.
And don't worry. For those of you listening, there we will. Most of our stuff is on the lighter side. If you've never tuned in before, everything is not war correspondence and kidnapping.
But maybe it should be. Well, it is, but it's more on the front lines of parenting and the war that goes on in our house. And, you know, how sometimes we don't always know if everyone's going to survive.
Right. Speaking of.
Yes, I have.
It's our weekly airing of grievances.
I got a good one.
And you've got a grievance.
Yeah, I got a reoccurring one that was aired. And now, and it actually fits in very well to what we were just talking about, strangely enough. So as I've gotten older, my periods have gotten heavier. Let's just be honest here, right? It fucking happens.
It's the worst.
It's the worst. And I moved away from tampons like a million years ago because I hate them. And I had started using the Diva Cup. And sometimes the Diva Cup does not fucking cut it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm a fan.
That's why I can't. I've tried.
Okay.
But I look like I murdered someone once in a Costco bathroom. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, like, you know, it's like a scene out of Aliens or something. It's not good. And it's happened twice. Same fucking Trader Joe's, walking around with my kids, and all of a sudden, like, realizing, like, I have like a 5 minute window that I got to get the fuck out of here because I don't really know what's happening, but it's not good. Like, I got to go. And thank God I have on black leggings, but like, right. This is like not, it's bad. And so I'm like trying to pull the kids out, you know, and it happened once before and it just happened the other day. And I had Lulu with me and I'm like, all right, Lou, we got to go. And she's like, why? I'm looking at the blah, blah. We have to get this. And I'm like, no, I got to come back. We got to go right now. And she's like, why? I'm like, Lulu, just come on. I was like, I have my period and my fucking Diva cup is like going to leak in a second. Like it's starting to leak now. Like we got to go. And she's like, oh, fine, mommy. And as we walk out the door, she turns to the fucking cashier and she goes, I'm just putting these back over here. We have to go because my mom has her period and her Diva cup is leaking and it's going all the way down her pants. So she told me we have to go. It's not fair that we have to leave.
Oh my God.
And I just, the guy and I lock eyes and he's like, just looks away from me like really fast. Like, right,
I'm sorry.
I don't want to look at you. And I'm like, yeah, peace out. Like we're going. And I'm like, get in the car, Lulu. And then I throw in the car and I just go, Lulu. I was like, really? Like, why do you have to tell people that? And she goes, what? That's why we had to go, right? What am I supposed to say? I go, say nothing.
Right. No one, right.
Like, say, put the apples back and walk out of the fucking store. No one was going to question you and be like, I'm sorry, why are you leaving, little girl?
Right.
You did not buy something in the Trader fucking Joe's. So she was like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I was like, great. Well, the second time you've done it.
Right.
And I still need to go home.
And
so
now, right.
Everybody knows I'm having my period. Bye. Like, it was, yeah, so that was the airing of grievances, and it was really great. So I didn't bleed out in Trader Joe's.
Wait, have you tried those underwear?
I have, and that's why what I would wear as a backup with the deep cup. And let me tell you, it's just, I also found out my fingers are a lot shorter than I thought. It's just a lot, of things that don't, you gotta like twist it like a light bulb in there.
Noise, I just can't. It's like a suction.
Oh, I know. I'm like a tampon girl. I can't go.
I need to try the.
We just lost the four male listeners that we have too.
Sorry.
Right. That's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. That's all right. They didn't belong necessarily. I need to try the organic ones.
To the dads out there that listen to our podcast, we're really sorry.
Dude, if their dads are listening to podcasts, they've seen much worse than what I just said. Because they've probably seen, you know, the end of childbirth. Unless
our gay dad audience.
Well, our
I'd like to think that we have a gay dad audience.
I'm
they might
sure
not
with you hosting that we do have a gay dad audience.
Just edging closer to gay icon.
I know.
So, thank you so much, Lindsay, for joining us today. You had some really incredible stories. I admire you. And here's to more kick-ass women. Maybe be them,
thank
maybe raise
you.
Them. And do you want to, speaking of kick-ass women and ways to find them.
What are you talking to me?
Don't look here. No.
Oh, okay. I was like, that's weird. Why would you be pointing at me?
It was my attempt at a segue. It was so
it was
shitty.
Not good.
It was so bad. God.
I tell Emily to cut it out, but she's not going to.
No, because my fails are funny.
It is. To me.
So,
Instagram. I know where you're going with this. You just want me to tell people where they can find us. I'm with you. I have to pull it up every time because I have no memory. it's only the name of our show, but whatever. Instagram is at Never Thought I'd Say This. Facebook is the same at Never Thought I'd Say This. Twitter is at Never Thought I'd. Lindsay, you're not usually here, so you don't know that. That's because someone had I Never Thought I'd Say This.
She's really upset about it.
It makes me mad every week. And then our email is neverthoughtid@protonmail.com.
Which is a real email address.
It is a real email address.
Yep. So yeah, you can find us. Send us your fail mails. Send us your airing of grievances. We always like to have
craptastic parenting moments.
Sure. Any input that you guys have for us, we would love to hear it. Thanks so much for joining us again on Never Thought I'd Say This. And remember, keep killing the parenting game.
And not your kids.
Never Thought I'd Say This is a co-production by Audioboom and Main Event Media.